just my true blue, right?
Get on the way in.
I usually get the desk.
The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome to an informational meeting on the overview of the Oregon University System. We've got a distinguished panel of guests, but before we invite President Vival up, I wanted to turn it over to Representative Harker, who had hoped to make some introductory comments.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I had hoped to do exactly this here and to thank so much people for coming to present to us today. I've had the pleasure and opportunity of having some one-on-one conversations with three of the four individuals here today, and I am, without exception, thrilled by their willingness to come here, state their case, and by their dedication to the process of higher education in this state. Higher education has played a very important role in my life, and it was all public education, and big part of why I am in the legislature and on this committee is to further the ability of good, solid higher education to the people of this state. So thank you so much for coming here and helping us out, and we should heed their words.
Well, thank you for extending that fine welcome from our committee. And with that, President Vival.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And before he starts to speak, I forgot to remind you all to please cut yourselves off from the rest of the world by turning off your cell phones, not placing them on vibrate. We're going to hear important things, and it messes up the sound system. So please turn them all the way off, laptop computers as well, if you have them in here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. For the record, I'm Vim Vival, president of Portland State University, and I've been there for all of 5 months now, and this is my maiden speech to a legislative committee, so please bear with me, and if I violate any rule of protocol, please feel free to remind me. I'll do my best.
Madam Chair, when do we get to start yelling?
At 1:11? 6 more minutes.
Okay. It really is wonderful to have an opportunity to talk to you. And in general, I've had a number of opportunities to talk to people in the Oregon and Portland community, and I've been uniformly impressed by the civility of everybody and the welcoming attitude and the graciousness. I'm new to Oregon, and I'm really, after only 5 months, have come to love this place and really be very impressed with it as both a physical environment and a political civic environment. And I just wish the economy were equally impressive right now, but we'll keep working on that. I'd like to talk to you about the five guiding themes of my administration at Portland State that build on the strategic planning that the institution had already been engaged in when I came, and that then we shaped some further to reflect some of the priorities that I thought made sense for the institution. And I think it's within the context of those five themes I'll be able to provide you with a lot of information about both the current state of Portland State and higher education in the Portland region, and both some of our points of pride and some of our concerns and issues. And then, of course, I'll be happy to take any questions. My first theme that I focus on relates to, I call, providing civic leadership through partnerships. It's a major part of really what has been my academic career, my belief that higher education has a huge role to play, and universities have a huge role to play in their communities, especially institutions like Portland State. It's become even more important now than perhaps it was 10 or 20 years ago when we first started talking about that in a global society, I firmly believe that city regions are the engines of economic competition, and much economic competition is based on the knowledge economy. And of course, universities play a key role in the knowledge economy. Urban universities and colleges, even though we often, when we talk about universities in the United States, we think about the pastoral campus out there in some beautiful area, but in reality, urban universities and colleges constitute 2/3, or 1,900, of the United States, 3,400 institutions of higher education. Collectively, these urban institutions spend about $250 billion a year, employ 2 million people to educate 10 million students. We truly are key players in the knowledge economy, and that's true for Portland State as well. And therefore, we have to play a local leadership role to address the whole range of issues that metropolitan areas face, not just think about our own narrow self-interest or even enlightened self-interest as a university. And I have found the Portland region to be very receptive to such a definition of the role of Portland State. This engagement with the metropolitan area is seen, for instance, in the community-based research projects that our students do through the Senior Capstone Project, where we do about 230 projects a year, constituting about 1.5 million volunteer hours annually. Our business outreach program has assisted more than 500 small and emerging businesses over the last 10 years. We were a recent recipient of the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Award for our Community Watershed Stewardship Program. This is one I'm particularly proud of because that involved working with 130 different community organizations on watershed issues, naturescaping, elementary school writing projects, and so on. But this is not just about community and neighborhood. It's also about partnering with the civic sector, with the political sector, and with the business community. It's, for instance, exemplified through our work with ONAMI, OTRADI, BEST, and all these other projects of the Oregon Innovation Council, where we try to address the economic needs of this area and the opportunity that partnering with the business community gives us. The next theme I call improving the quality of the student experience. Of course, you cannot be a civic leader if you don't take care of home, if you don't do your core business well. The key challenge for Portland State there has been to improve our retention and graduation rate, which frankly, historically, has not been what it should be. We've done a great job with graduate students. We've done a great job with transfer students. We have not done as well with students coming in as freshmen. And this, I've made an area of high priority. It involves things like improving the advising that we do, creating a better campus climate. One way to do that is to create more student housing, and we're just now negotiating for adding more beds. Right now we have 2,030 on campus. I think we can easily house something like 4,000, perhaps even 5,000 students. And this, of course, creates more activity, provides opportunity for more student organizations, and we know that all of that is correlated with student success. Also, of course, it would help to be able to improve our student-faculty ratio. Now, there are things like that that, because of the growth we've had, we've not been able to address. The third theme I talk about is achieving global excellence. The residents of the Portland region are entitled to a public university that's not just adequate, but that's excellent. You should not have to go out of town or go to a private university to get an excellent education. Indeed, I would say that for the future of the Portland region, its economic well-being, it is imperative that we make Portland State an excellent public urban research university. Now, you can't be excellent in everything. That's public relations, perhaps, but not reality. So we are picking themes to focus on. And the first one that had already been picked before I came was sustainability. This is an area in which we already had about 70 or so faculty doing work. It obviously is interdisciplinary, and it clearly has huge branding synergy with what's already going on in the Portland region and indeed what Oregon as a state is known for. And we see that benefit, and I've just been so impressed coming from Maryland, where I was the last 4 years, and Illinois before that. I think it's easy to lose sight when you're here of how big the sustainability thing actually is and how much it is in the air we breathe, literally, and in how people think about the culture and the future of this region. I think it really does hold promise, of course, for the country as a whole to lead us out of the economic downturn. I got a little lucky. The Miller Foundation came along and decided that not so much that they wanted to support sustainability, actually, but that they wanted to support Portland. And that the way to support Portland was to support Portland State. And then they asked us, well, if we're going to support you, how are you going to do that? And that's how we focused. We said, well, sustainability is our key theme. And so that's what they're supporting for us. We focus on four areas: the integration of human societies and the natural environment. That's sort of some of those boundary issues, for instance, that occur. Creating sustainable urban communities. You know, you cannot contain sprawl if you don't have a sustainable place right in the city. Implementing sustainability and mechanisms of change. Change is never easy, we know that. And measuring sustainability. You've probably all heard the word greenwash. You know, anytime there's a popular new fad, there's a lot of banter and a lot of stuff that isn't really quite true. As a university, we cannot engage in the PR. We have to do the serious research and show what really matters, what really makes a difference. We are using the first years of the Miller Grant to make internal awards. We got 99 proposals involving over 150 faculty. One of my standard statements, of course, or one of many people's standard statements about managing faculty is that it's like herding cats. And I've learned that to herd cats, you rattle the food ball. And the Miller Grant has been a very effective food ball. And it has generated a lot of faculty interest and enthusiasm. In this first round on campus, we'll fund work on natural resources, clean energy, and green buildings while increasing capacity in our education and the curriculum. We've also been able to use this to leverage some bond money that we had not yet been able to leverage, about $900,000 worth, that will allow us to buy more equipment in the engineering college. This has also generated additional private support because, as you know, or as you may know, the Miller Grant, while it's $2.5 million a year, we have to match it one-on-one. So we are using this to generate additional money from others. We will also be supporting student centers initiatives, including a career center initiative around jobs and sustainability, a student sustainability idea generator, and other things. You, of course, know that in the governor's recommended budget, there is $80 million in capital funding to build a sustainability center that would bring together both for-profit and not-for-profit organizations involved in sustainability, which the current plan is would be located close to our campus. It's not ours, but we would work very closely with those organizations. A wonderful example of synergy. Now, there are other parts of excellence. One big one to me is the whole notion of diversity. Diversity is part of excellence. If you want to compete globally, you have to have students who understand how to work with diverse human populations, with people who come from very different cultures. That means that you have to have diverse faculty and staff, as well as diverse students. Another way is to attract more international students. Right now, about 6% of our student body is international. I would like to increase it to about 10%, to sort of leaven the student body a bit. And at the same time, I want to create more opportunities for our students to study abroad in other than the typical junior year abroad model, which most of our students can't do because they're working, so we do a lot of short courses. We also will greatly expand the collaboration that we already have with our colleagues at Oregon Health and Science University. We think that we can reap many of the synergies of collaboration through working with them rather than, I know some of the proposals that have been discussed about mergers, which have a lot of bureaucratic problems and organizational problems with it. We already provide most of the students to the medical school. We're going to do more and more with them. One of our work is the joint research that we do. Engineering Associate Professor Jim McNames, who works on Parkinson's research, who's been working with doctors at OHSU to create a device that measures a patient's condition and fine-tunes therapeutic adjustments. A patient could wear such a device and receive precisely controlled electrical brain stimulation. I've seen a demonstration of it. It's really very powerful. And we have other examples in the area of anti-malarial drugs and other chemistry fields. We also have opportunities for joint appointments. We just announced on Friday we signed the agreement for the joint MBA in healthcare management. We, of course, work together with OHSU and others on the joint degree on public health. And finally, the capital construction funding request in the governor's budget also includes the life sciences building that is joint with many of us in the Oregon University System and OHSU, which will greatly expand our capacity to do first-class research. It'll be a wonderful building on the south waterfront, desperately needed for us to continue to attract top-flight scientists. And if any of you have not had the chance to see our science building too, which we're going to renovate, but I got a tour there just in the fall, and on the fourth floor, the water was coming in through these light fixtures. Now, it was a rainy day, admittedly. After I walked past, I told the chair of chemistry, you could now turn off the faucet. I got the point. The fourth theme that I will talk about just briefly relates to expanding educational opportunity. We are part of the P-20 system. One of the first things I did when I came to Portland was meet with Carol Smith, the Portland Public Schools superintendent, and we agreed to create a joint task force that has been meeting over the fall and will be issuing its report very soon to systematize our collaborations. We already had a whole bunch of projects, and they're all wonderful projects, but they weren't necessarily always strategic. They were developed based on the individual interest of faculty and where they could find teachers to work with them. I want to make sure that we use our resources, which is really faculty and student time, as effectively as possible. So we will focus on the area of transition to college, which of course fits closest with what we know, as well as teacher training and professional development for educators. We also provide quality research on areas such as special education. Dr. Jim Bickford coordinates the sole program in the Northwest, as far as I know, that prepares teachers of blind or visually impaired children. We also will improve our delivery modes. We do remarkably little online education. I have found in my previous institution that online education is a very effective way to serve the clientele. Our students are often working, they're often adults, and you can't say, yes, we're here to serve you, but you got to come to class Tuesday and Thursday from 4 to 6. By doing online education, we can serve these people better. It's not to serve people in, you know, Kokomo, Indiana, or Timbuktu. It's to serve these people here in a way that fits their schedule, which may be requiring them to learn at 10 o'clock at night rather than at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Finally, as part of the collaboration with P-20, we, of course, have the partnerships with Oregon's community colleges. We have formal partnerships with Chemeketa, Clackamas, Clark, Clatsop, Mount Hood, and Portland Community Colleges. I hope I got all those names right. Which allows students to co-enroll at the community colleges and PSU. And again, I know my colleague institutions have similar programs. This will give students greater flexibility and wider choices. We also have signed an agreement with Portland Community College to locate programs in their new educational facility being built at the Willow Creek Transit Center. That finally brings me to the fifth and final theme, maximizing resources and efficiency. You're probably wondering when I was going to talk about money. I know that you're not really the money committee. You care about what we actually do with the money, if I understand it correctly. Now, my big point, and I've been making it internally as well as externally, is that there's never enough money to do what we want to do. And that's not a measure of anything. Truly, I have these friends at Harvard who always complain about not having enough money. And they're right, they don't have enough money, because our hopes and dreams will always exceed what we're able to do. And if they don't, it means we've gone to sleep. So that's not an issue. We will continue to push for resources without sitting down and whining about it. We aim to double external grants and contracts over the next 6 years and increase philanthropic support. Of course, right now it's a little hard to ask for money, but those times will change. And I see nothing but upside for us there, because we have not, as a public university, paid all that much attention to that until about the last half dozen years or so. We have 120,000 alumni and a very small endowment. We have lots of room for improvement, even though our endowment has declined from $37 million to $26 million. As I've been telling people, the good thing about having a small endowment is that we never counted on much money from it anyway, so, you know, it doesn't hurt that bad. Of course, even focusing on foundation and external support, state funding is critical, and we couldn't operate without it. We are very grateful for the governor's prioritization of higher education in his proposed budget, and we hope that even as the economic projections deteriorate, you will be able to maintain as much of that as possible and fund the Oregon University System request as well as the Oregon Opportunity Grant request. As you know, we were faced with a shortfall, and we just announced on Friday that we will use institutional funds to make up 75% of the shortfall for those students who are starting this term. That will cost us about $300,000. We do not have foundation funds. All of our foundation funds are essentially underwater. So we are just not doing some things that we would have done. Improve classrooms, buy new technology, hire support staff, things like that. We're just holding back because we feel that these students need this money now. We can't do this on an ongoing basis. This is a one-time event. As you know, that even with the governor's best efforts in his original recommended budget, the budget still falls short of the essential budget level. It does not pay us for the enrollment growth we had in the last 6 years. In the current biennium, we get paid for half the enrollment growth we had the last 6 years. Portland State sort of got caught there by growing rapidly at a time where there was no funding, so we just had the tuition money, not the state funding. It does not allow us to make progress on bringing faculty salaries up to that of peers, and it does not allow us to reduce student-faculty ratios. With education, all of those things have real consequences. They don't always show up on the next day. The effect is more insidious and slow, but it's real nonetheless. I've been talking to our students on campus who emphasize affordability and accessibility. And I've told them that to have access to cheap education that's no good, doesn't help anybody, that you have to talk about quality. And I did not come here to run a third-rate institution. I came here to run an excellent institution. I look forward to working with all of you and would welcome your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Person of Thatcher?
Well, since I see anybody else raise your hand. You were talking about wages, and I'm wondering if that's affected turnover in your staff as far as faculty, and if that also impacts the quality.
Well, at present, you know, this is one of those, you know, silver linings or whatever, that since universities all over the country are having trouble, it probably is slowing down people moving out because we're not the only ones having a hard time. I know that in many specialized areas we've had tremendous trouble, IT being the main one, where our salaries are not competitive and we essentially have been serving as a training ground in our staff, which is a very expensive way of operating because it means that every time somebody gets to know the system, after about 12 to 18 months, they leave and they go to work for another organization. Among faculty, I see it more reflected in faculty morale than actually huge numbers of people leaving. People feeling that they're underpaid, underappreciated. How much that's reflected then in what they do in the actual classroom, that's sort of a hard thing to prove. But as you know, we had a very contentious negotiations this past year, which fortunately got settled just before I came in. And that leaves scars, and that's going to affect people's ability to do the best job possible.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, welcome, Mr. President. I'm a representative from Portland, and actually I have long experience at your sister institution, Portland Community College.
Right.
So I'm really pleased to hear you talk about partnerships, which I think really could be developed further. We're bringing faculty together from the K-12 disciplines and the community colleges and the university, I think, would really be excellent. My question actually goes back to what you were saying about quality and the challenges to quality. Are you finding that, you know, with the stress of the budget, your faculty is moving more in the direction of contingency, you know, away from, you know, permanent full-time positions, more to part-time? And what kind of challenges do you see arising from that?
Yeah, Well, absolutely. It shows up in a variety of places. It shows up in the fact that many of our classes are just too large because we can't afford to offer new sections. So we kind of make these calculations where we figure, well, on average a class has maybe a 5% attrition rate in the first few weeks, you know, whatever the number is, I don't know. So we start out with literally many classes standing room only. Well, that kind of causes the attrition too, right?
Yeah.
Because who wants to be in a class that is standard? What signal does it send to students and to faculty about how you respect them? You know, how would you feel here, right? Well, you probably think you're meeting with a great success against them. But it doesn't really promote learning. We have hugely increased the number of both full-time but non-tenure-track faculty and part-time adjunct faculty over the past 10 years. And while I always think that having some percentage of faculty like that is wonderful, in fact, and is an asset, something like maybe having 25% of your course credits delivered by adjunct faculty, I think is a real asset because we're fortunate to be in a metropolitan region where we have many wonderfully skilled people who in professional fields have the most up-to-date and current experience, who love to teach. So it makes academic sense as well as being an economic fact of life. But when it gets to be over 50%, you're losing what a university like this is supposed to be about, which is to have people who are involved in research, who are fully dedicated to the pedagogy, fully dedicated to being available for students. You know, that's what the universities are based on. So we are well over anything that can be considered desirable in terms of the number of adjunct faculty, and we just keep having to do more and more of it because it's the only way to run a railroad.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Your non-traditional student population, I'm looking for some information, and do you have a sense of your over 25 population? I mean, I see
those would be our traditional students.
Yeah,
it would be the 18-year-olds.
Okay. No, actually, that's
true.
Okay.
Well, I'm being
somewhat facetious, but not totally.
Not totally.
Okay.
It is very interesting that, you know, that is, you're of course using the standard language for it, that the 18-year-old is considered to be the traditional student.
Mm-hmm.
I think Portland State has really, from its beginning, when it served the returning veterans, catered to an adult population, and it has continued to do that over the years. We are actually trying to build up the traditional population, because we think that we're offering a wonderful experience for them. And as cities have once again become wonderful places for people to go, I think cities have been able to draw people, places like GW in D.C. and NYU in New York and DePaul in Chicago, as well as my old institution, University of Illinois Chicago, have once again become popular. Portland State can do that too, and that's one of the reasons why, of course, we want to build housing. But we want to do that without in any way forsaking our traditional role of serving the adult students of the region. And if you want particular percentages, I can give you to those, but not right now. I'd have to look those up.
He's all right. He's UIC grad, so.
Did you ever?
No, my wife is. Northern Illinois.
Okay, close enough.
This Midwestern connection is good. I'm impressed that you know Kokomo, Indiana. I lived in a small town right outside of Kokomo.
I spent 2 years in purgatory in South Bend, Indiana.
I'm sorry. Representative Van Orman.
Madam Chair, could I just say my graduate program was at Indiana University, and I feel sympathy for you having to be in South Bend.
There's this little stretch between Portland and Salem where it's all flat, and if you don't look at the mountains on the horizon, it sort of looks like Illinois. As well as my home country of the Netherlands.
Well, returning back to the great Pacific Northwest. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sitting here thinking about my beautiful Wisconsin just north. So, I think one of the things, probably more of a comment than a question, and it's about the Metropolitan Institute
the Institute of Metropolitan Studies. I was on the advisory board a few years ago, and I have high praise for what they're doing. And the production of the Metroscape that they send to us is really a valuable publication that tells us what's going on in the metro area. And so of course, I have to support my Dr. Ethan Seltzer. So I will gladly talk about that in complimentary terms. I will talk to you privately about my experience as a student.
Good. Well, it is a wonderful institute. Right now, Ethan was, of course, the director for a long time. Now Sheila Martin is the director, who is really doing a wonderful job. I'm working very closely with her. We're organizing a two-day conference sponsored by the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy on sustainable economic development and the role of universities, which, of course, fits perfectly with
yes.
what we've been doing in the builds and some of the work I've been doing previously. And, yes, that's a true gem and asset, as any number of wonderful, you know, because I forgot to make that point, that in addition to picking sustainability and health-oriented research in the broadest sense as clear areas of sustainability that transcend disciplines, we have many others that are perhaps narrower, that don't quite rise to the level of an institution-wide commitment, but that are very, very strong. You know, things like our opera program. You know, who knew? But, you know, it's wonderful. The speech and hearing program. You know, there are other specific fields where we are very competitive nationally.
Thank you. Representative Parker.
Thanks for all of this. I wonder if you would like to expand a little bit at all on the Life Sciences Center and how you're thinking about that. As myself being a former biomedical researcher coming out here as a faculty member at OHSU, I was lucky to work at that institution, but I always felt that it lacked the vitality of an institution that was associated with a vibrant undergraduate institution. And so I think that the Life Sciences Center here affords the beginnings of or the next step in that type of relationship between these institutions and, of course, bringing in OSU and others. So
yeah,
some thoughts there, if you would?
Well, yeah, it's an area that is just such a perfect match. First of all, the hallmark of being a truly excellent university is the integration of the research with the education piece. That these are not separate things. And that's ultimately what makes us universities. There are many other institutions that do different things, and they have a role in the place, but that's what we do. That's what makes us distinct. And clearly, the sciences is such a huge area. It's the area where there's so much funding available. You have to be competitive in that if you're going to be a serious research university. It holds so much promise for the future of the region. It is such an important part. You know, all of us in bodies like this know about the aging of the population and the kind of medical needs that so many of us are going to have. So it's an area of tremendous promise. If you do not play in that arena, you cannot be a premier type of institution. We have a great opportunity having OHSU just literally up the hill with all its wonderful researchers as well as its huge clinical practice, and that provides the opportunity. And then we're fortunate enough to have this space on the South Waterfront where you can actually do new things without having to worry about displacing people or accessibility or anything like that. And finally, you cannot do excellent research unless you have excellent facilities. You know, it's true. I'm a sociologist and urban planner. Frankly, you can teach sociology in almost any space, you know, because, I mean, you need a computer and a PowerPoint and all that. But, you know, you can do it. But you can't do top-flight research in a crummy lab. It just doesn't work. It's expensive. It requires constant renovation. So this is just a great opportunity to be able to, you know, put us way ahead of where we are now. And again, I invite you to come see some of our other buildings, and you'll see that, you know, this will put us, you know, I mean, the standard joke would be to say it will put us in one fell swoop into the 20th century. But hopefully we'll do better than that and really get us at least some top flight laboratory space.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative
Dimbro? Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the subject of educational partnerships, you know, you talked about partnerships with K-12, with community colleges. I wonder if you could talk about partnerships with the other OUS institutions. Sometimes we hear complaints that, there's an OSU center in Portland, there's a U of O center in Portland, and we're duplicating our efforts. And my understanding is that we are not duplicating our efforts, but rather it's a coordinated policy. And I wonder if you could talk about that and perhaps think of some ways that perhaps we could better get that message out to the public, that this is really part of a concerted strategy.
It's a good point, and especially this business about getting a message out, because I've actually been very impressed, especially in comparison to Maryland, where there was a lot of competition between the institutions with the collegiality of the institutions here. And in general, I found that to be the case for Oregon as sort of a civic culture. I've alluded a couple of times, right? The life sciences building is an example. It involves the other OUS institutions. At Oregon Institute of Technology, it runs certain programs in the Portland region, and I've been talking to President Chris Mables about the exact linkage between what they do and what we do, because they offer certain programs that we have no either capacity or interest in offering, and it's great to have them offered, and they transition very well into some of the things we do. There are some similar things with Eastern Oregon. The Sustainability Center that would be near our campus, we're working very hard. My provost, Roy Cook, has been asked on behalf of all the provosts to figure out what programs of the other institutions would be housed there as well. We talk all the time. We have both a monthly board meeting and the day before that the presidents meet for a couple of hours, and then in between we meet. Frankly, I talk to these presidents more than I've ever talked to colleagues at other institutions. So there's really a lot going on. You are right that a message doesn't come across. People just love to talk about the White Stag building. That's like the White Stag building is 100,000 square feet. Portland State has 4.5 million square feet. This should somehow or other make me upset and feel that the University of Oregon is offering programs there that we don't do. That's wonderful. That's great. You can't say that you believe in the importance of higher education and then say, and I'm the only one who can do it. Nobody else can do it. You just want to be smart about it and make sure you continue to, fine-tune what each other is doing. But I haven't run into any problems along those lines.
Well, thank you very much for coming today and sharing your maiden voyage with the Oregon Legislature with this committee. I hope you'll be back. I do know we'll probably have a hearing on a bill related to the Oregon Health Sciences University, PSU, ongoing discussion. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And Susan Weeks. Welcome. Thank you for coming this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Weeks. I'm OUS Vice Chancellor for Strategic Programs and Planning. And I'm very pleased to be able to talk about some of our legislative priorities. President Vivelle is a very hard act to follow, but I'll try and keep your attention at least for the next few minutes on our major priorities. I've been with the Chancellor's Office for 29 years, so I'm kind of a veteran of the ups and downs of our economy and our budgets, and it's always unfortunate we have to face these tough times, but I'm optimistic, and I hope what I present to you today will highlight some of the very positive things and the returns on the investment that Oregon and the legislature has made already. You'll see in some of the information that I've provided where we've seen the fruits of those investments already, as well as some of the challenges that we're facing. Let me start, if I might, by looking at, you should have a packet that has on the top of it a table in blue and white that says where Oregon ranks on selected national indicators related to public four-year institutions. This is a summary of some information that, and I'm going to do a little shameless advertising here of our new fact book. We produce an OUS system fact book every 2 years. This, I snagged a copy off the printer, apparently was ready yesterday afternoon, and so you will all be getting a copy of this sometime very soon. But there is a lot of good stuff in here, and a lot of that good stuff went into what you have in your packet. On this table, let me just highlight a few things and talk about why these particular indicators are meaningful and important for you to be aware of, and what they say about our system, what they say about our state. I put at the top of this, this isn't really a higher ed indicator, but the New Economy Index is an index, this is a 2007 update. It's based on a set of 29 indicators that are calculated. Oh, it's calculated from 29 indicators that are related to the knowledge economy. And so you can see in the fine print there what some of those areas are. Oregon actually ranks pretty highly on that New Economy Index. In the previous one, we ranked even higher than 17th. We were 17th in the 2007 version. We had been, I think, 12th or thereabouts about 5 years ago. But we're still relatively highly ranked on this index compared to other states. In the indicator right below that, the percent of our population with a bachelor's degree or higher, we rank 18th. We're above the U.S. average. A lot of that, as I'm sure you're aware, came about because those of us who are baby boomers came to Oregon, particularly during the 1990s, and so a lot of the contribution to that indicator and to our ranking comes from those who migrated into the state. And as I think you have already heard, one of the major thrusts of the governor and of all of our sectors within education is aiming toward a 40-40-20 goal by 2025, and because we need to have homegrown Oregonians with bachelor's degrees, not just those coming from California or Arizona or other places in the country. The next indicator is not as high. Enrollment per 10,000 people, we're 31st. If we're going to not only maintain but improve our position on the New Economy Index, this is a key indicator. We have to be able to enroll and educate people to be part of that knowledge economy. Bachelor's degrees awarded per 10,000 people awarded by public four-year institutions were ranked pretty highly there, 22nd, which given the resources that you'll see as we get down the list that we've had over the past 15 years or so, we've done pretty well in producing degrees. Our graduation rate is ranked 20th. We do pretty well, not as well as we'd like to. We aim to improve our retention and completion, but we actually do pretty well compared to other states in graduating students with a four-year degree. The next indicator and the next couple of indicators I think are pretty interesting and important. The federal research and development dollars per faculty, we rank 7th in the country. We've got incredibly productive Oregon research faculty. And that rank has been pretty constant for the last several years. We've made some real strides in the research area. But if you look at the indicator right below that, which is faculty compensation in public doctoral granting institutions, you can see the real risk we face in maintaining that level of productivity with faculty, because we're clearly not competitive. Even when you include benefits, we're not competitive with the rest of the country on faculty compensation. Our average tuition and fees for full-time, first-time freshmen, we're about average in the country. As you can see, ours are slightly lower than the U.S. average, but we rank 23rd, and so we're about in the middle. Average student debt at graduation, we're relatively high, but this, I want to point out that indicator does not take into account the appropriation for the opportunity grant last session or the ongoing monies for opportunity grants. So hopefully we'll see that ranking. That's one where you want to be a bit lower on. We'll hopefully see that come down in the future as students have the benefit of the opportunity grant. And then finally, our state appropriation per FTE, we rank 45th. And this is actually an improvement. We were worse. So this is the collection of these, I think, show that we do quite a bit with very little. And so far, we've, I think, done better than one might expect in many of these measures, given the level of resource that we have. So that's sort of the overview of where the university system is on some of these indicators. And we will be getting into more detail on these with the Ways and Means Subcommittee as well. But I wanted you to have sort of a sense of where we stand now and how competitive Oregon is. The next three tables and graphs in your packet come from this new fact book and give you more of the detail on freshman participation rate, which is the proportion of the high school, the Oregon high school graduates that we take in as freshmen in our institutions. The fall headcount enrollment and the degrees awarded over a period of time. And I just want to point out a couple of things on these. I won't take a lot of time with them. There's a lot of data in them. And you'll see this and more in the fact book when you get it. But in the freshman participation rate, if you look down at the graph at the bottom of the page, you'll see where it has gone up and down. As in the early 1990s, when with the passage of ballot measure 5, we had to make a lot of program cuts and enrollment cuts, tuition increases, and our freshman participation rate just plummeted. And it continued down that slide until about 1999, when there was an infusion of state dollars appropriated by the legislature. And you can see what happened. That started, that had an immediate effect of bringing that freshman participation rate back up. As we got to the early part of this century and had a downturn in our economy again, that started sliding down. But now we're hoping that with the, particularly with the opportunity grant, that will start increasing again. Likewise, you can see the similar trends if you look at the numbers on the headcount enrollment and with the degrees awarded, the lag time of 4 to 6 years. As we got that infusion in 1999, 4 to 6 years later, you're seeing the result in the degrees awarded. So I wanted to point those trends out to you. And then finally, not on the chart, but I do want to point out that with respect to our own administrative efficiencies, that our system and most institutions spend less on administration and physical plant expenses than their peers. And so we try to be as efficient as possible. We believe, and the board certainly believes, that job one is increasing educational attainment and making Oregon more competitive. And I would suggest there are five elements or mechanisms by which we do that. The first is that we have a very diverse array of institutions, 7 institutions in the system that reflect a mix of mission, size, program availability, and geographic location to serve the very diverse needs that we have in this state. The second is a very serious focus on student success, helping students to enter college, helping them to learn effectively and complete their degrees. We think it's important to prepare our students for high-wage jobs. We know that from the data from the Employment Division that about 3/4 of high-wage jobs will require at least a bachelor's degree to be competitive, if not a graduate degree. And that is, we see that as a very strong part of our mission and role. And in general, preparing Oregonians for the knowledge economy. The third area is the development of strong economic drivers, the faculty research and innovation, capital construction, which provides many thousands of jobs, and the development of clean technologies, which, as President Vivell mentioned, is a major thrust for not only for Portland State, but for our entire system and for the state of Oregon. The fourth area is, as President Vivell mentioned, critical partnerships across the Oregon University system, across the education continuum with our K-12 and community college partners, and as well as private colleges, with other areas of state and local government. We have library consortia, extension service through Oregon State, reaches every part of the state, and then with business and industry through such organizations as ETIC and the Signature Research Centers through Oregon Inc. And finally, the fifth sort of leg of this is an effective and supportive policy infrastructure. We need policies, principles, operating guidelines, and regulation that supports the most efficient and effective management of our system. One example, and there we have a bill to be able to retain the interest earnings on non-state funds. That would allow us to manage our resources, I think, more effectively and certainly more efficiently. The Board of Higher Education has a long-term strategic plan. And the focus currently of that plan is on addressing many of the challenges that we're facing now in our current economic environment, but that we have identified as long-term challenges as well. There are really two areas of priority. One is focusing on educational attainment and student success. We have a board committee on student participation and completion, which has engaged many communities across the state, across our system, with other institutions outside of our system and in various communities to try and facilitate access to and success of students, particularly those who are underserved or otherwise at risk. And secondly, the second thrust of the board is to advance innovation for Oregon's vitality through the support for the Oregon Inc. programs, ONAMI, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, through Oregon BEST, the Built Environment Sustainable Technologies, and as President Vivelle mentioned, sustainability is a big focus for the entire system. Portland State has taken the lead in many areas of that, but every institution has a commitment to this area as a major signature focus for the entire system. The board now has a sustainability initiatives committee that is focused on coordinating those efforts, both through instruction but also research and through operations and capital projects in the system, so that we have a coordinated approach to sustainability. We also have the board has a Portland Higher Education Committee, which is focused particularly on the needs of the Portland area, but also in partnership with other institutions in other areas. We're building on an investment that the legislature made in 2007-09 that was, we think of as a multi-biennial strategy, a very long-term strategy. It doesn't just stop with one biennium, to improve student success, make college education more affordable, to build the infrastructure through capital construction projects, and to build innovation, the capacity through research and other innovation to improve the capacity of the state to perform well and be competitive in the knowledge economy. Building on that, the governor's recommended budget in 2009-11 focuses on four key themes that we think are very critical to both the state and its current immediate need, but also the very long term. The first area is student success, having funding support to have more students prepared, enrolled, retained, and complete to graduation and a degree. Part of this would increase our enrollment by fall 2010 to over 89,000 students. The proposals in the governor's budget place particular emphasis on the underserved students, those who are first generation, low income, rural, students of color, and others who historically have not participated in college. And these are the students who will make up an increasing proportion of the population in the future. We need to address their needs and our needs. And through these improvements in enrollment and retention and graduation, we think this will be a big step toward advancing the state's goal of having 40% of adults with at least a bachelor's degree by 2025. The second area is affordability, with, again, increases in the Oregon Opportunity Grant to make, in combination with continuing modest increases in tuition and campus financial assistance, making college affordable. Those are all three components that are critical to have together. You can't do one without the other. But in combination, that should help make college affordable for students. The board has a commitment to, and the governor as well, to using the shared responsibility model approach that gives students a stake in paying for their education. We've seen already what a difference that the funding has made for the opportunity grant in student demand. Our numbers are up, and particularly in freshmen, in some cases, surprisingly so. We're almost caught us by surprise, the level of demand and use for them. The infrastructure is another area. We're looking at investments of almost $980 million compared to $761 million in 2007-09 in capital construction, repair, and deferred maintenance that will help immediately in providing thousands of new construction and ancillary jobs and on many projects dispersed throughout the state. Projects that could be underway within a matter, in some cases, of weeks or even months, could be very short, immediate help for our economic situation. These projects will extend student access and safety by providing additional classroom space, better technology in facilities, and seismic readiness. And what's built into the governor's budget will also make significant progress on OUS deferred maintenance backlog, which is now about $640 million. These investments could reduce that by nearly $100 million. And finally, the fourth area, it would be clean technologies and innovation. President Vivel talked about some of those areas that are occurring at Portland State. Sustainability, again, is a major focus for OUS and the board, and are part of this, the Sustainability Center. He described the there are also four renewable energy projects built into this in Eugene, Klamath Falls, Corvallis, and then statewide with some wind power demonstration projects. Climate Change Research Institute, and as President Vivel mentioned, the Life Sciences Collaborative Complex. We do face some real challenges. The first, I think, as I've mentioned, is just sort of maintaining momentum and focus in this very tough environment. This, our view and the board's view is that this is a very long-term focus. This is not a single biennium or even two biennia. We're looking very long-term at what it takes to reinvest, to build a sustainable higher education system that will allow Oregon to become and sustain a competitive edge in the country in many ways, not just economically, but in terms of civic vitality as well. The changing demographics pose some real challenges for us. There are two areas, and I want to refer to the last piece of your packet, which is kind of a funny-looking graph. A lot of dots on, or squares and diamonds on it, but I circled the data for Oregon. This is a graph that shows the difference between the bachelor's degree attainment for younger working age adults and older working age adults. And in Oregon, as in many other Western states, the older working age adults are better educated than the younger working age adults. As those of us who are baby boomers move into retirement, and certainly over the next 20 years, there will be a lot of us moving into retirement, the cohort behind us is not as well educated as those leaving. And that is a challenge for us to start building that capacity in the state now. We also are challenged by the fact that demographically we're becoming a much more diverse population, particularly with the growth in the Latino population. And many of these populations have historically had very low college participation rates, and so it's even more critical to bring all of those citizens into provide them the opportunity to participate in higher education, acquire a college degree, and become part of the Oregon economy and Oregon civic infrastructure. We also need to, as a system, serve the needs of all of Oregon, including those in rural areas, which are more challenging because the educational attainment of rural Oregon is about half of what it is in the more urbanized areas. And so there are particular challenges there. And these are areas of the state that have been particularly hard hit by the economy as well. So these the age differences in aging baby boomers, the more diverse demographics of our state, and the challenges of rural Oregon are all things that are going to challenge the board, challenge our initiatives, challenge us to move ahead and be competitive in the future. I'll close in saying that we've seen, and I won't dwell on what some of the consequences have been in the past of disinvestment, but in the during the 1990s, we have what we call a lost generation of students who didn't enroll, people who could have but didn't because of our budget cuts. And we estimate that by the year 2000, had we been able to enroll those students in our systems, and both at the community colleges and in OUS, we could have achieved, by the year 2000, about parity with the rest of the country in the proportion of young people with bachelor's degrees. Instead, we were in the bottom third or thereabouts in the country at that point. We're now recovering. We're about in the middle now, but it's taken much longer, and we don't want to see that happen again. But we've also seen on the other side of it what happens when you do make an investment. In 1999 and again in 2007, we've seen immediate effects of investment in higher education with enrollment, subsequently degrees produced, with students having access, being able to afford college. It makes a huge difference. We want to build on our current successes. We think some of them are a bit fragile right now, but we do have some real strengths. The board and our institutions are committed to making student success and knowledge creation a top priority. We hope you will be too, and I would be very happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Are there questions?
I have one. You talked about the impact of policy choices we make at the legislature, the investment in the opportunity grants, the investment that came in 1999. Do you see an impact in your enrollment and retention when the state makes choices to help families make colleges more affordable? For instance, we give a large tax credit for our Oregon 529 savings plan. Does that increase your enrollment in universities, or do those students tend to leave the state or go to private universities?
To the extent that in the past we have done some survey work where we've looked at why students make the choices they make. Mm-hmm. When the state has made the investment, students, and especially the brighter students, tend to stay home. They go to our institutions here. When the state has not made that investment, we've seen students leave the state and make other choices outside of Oregon. We also know that when there have been even the threat or perception that there will be cuts or a budget decline in some way in the system, that students respond pretty immediately to that and hesitate before enrolling. It's a very vulnerable population, and they are critical consumers. And when there is opportunity, they'll stay. When there's not, sometimes not.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming today. We appreciate it. President Frommeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Frommeyer. I'm currently serving as president of the University of Oregon. And it's my real privilege to appear before you today, and thank you for making the time on your agenda for this overview of higher education. We very much appreciate the chance to do that unencumbered by appropriations issues, and those, I'm sure, are to come. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I think many of you know, some years ago I had the privilege of sitting on your side of the dais on the House Education Committee. And putting myself back in that position, which may seem harder and harder these days, I thought I might respond to you in the way that I think I appreciated testimony at that time, which is on issues such as this. I'm sure you want to know the overall impact of higher education as you assess that broad landscape. Secondly, you'd want to know, I thought, how our students were served and how many are served. Third, how we're doing in terms of progress on that important objective, particularly as we are very much in the midst of our knowledge economy. And finally, what keeps people like me awake at night, or at least in terms of the legislature's response, what is helpful and what is not so helpful in terms of legislative reactions to stewardship of this vast enterprise of which you are in some significant way members of the Board of Trustees. So that would be my proposed framework for the brief time that we have together. Let me say that I would, of course, welcome interruptions or questions really at any time. So if that's satisfactory, Madam Chair, let me proceed. First of all, the overall impact. I think we know, Dr. Week's testimony, which has just preceded me, is some index of the importance of education in our modern society. The difference in raw earning power between a person who has only a high school diploma as opposed to someone who has a college degree, that gap is worldwide and it's increasing. And there's no reason to suspect that that gap will really be narrowed. So knowledge really is personal currency. It's capacity to cope. It takes us, in many cases, the difference between being, Barbara Ehrenreich put it, nickeled and dimed the rest of our lives and having a chance for the middle-class dream. So I don't think I need to overestimate for this committee the importance of the capacity and the opportunity to have higher education. In terms of raw economic impact, the institutions of higher education in this state probably have been underestimated. So we've done some estimates for each of the institutions, and I would tell you that this is done by economists whose work has been peer-reviewed in this area. And I can start with my own university, the University of Oregon. In terms of state appropriation, we receive probably about $80 million a year. For that $80 million of state tax investment, we return $1.2 billion to the state's and region's economy each single year. And most of that money comes from out of state. It comes from federal grants and research. It comes from non-resident students. It comes from federal financial aid. And it comes from a variety of sources that reinforce the local economy. 87% of what we spend is spent in the state of Oregon. So it is really a net importer of capital and opportunity and, frankly, high-wage jobs. I would tell you that the figure for Oregon State University is probably larger than ours. Because they have a larger federal research budget, and they have extension arms that quite literally reach into every single county of Oregon and have a huge economic impact, technical assistance impact. President Vivelle of Portland State University told me that their economic impact is right around $1 billion. And Oregon Health and Sciences University is probably another $1 billion. So those four educational institutions, which are either state-supported or state-connected, have already a $4 billion impact simply by existing. And at a time when we're deeply worried about our economic situation, they constitute a powerful engine for stability and perhaps even for growth for this economy. So the very existence of these institutions helps to define the difference as to whether we are to some degree self-determined or someone else's economic colony. And I think it's important to have that perspective because we think of all the other benefits of higher education without considering even the fundamental base of professional, technical, and other job opportunities that it provides, and beyond that, the knowledge to our larger economy. So that's some sense for the landscape of the overall economic impact, and I'm, as you know, only touching the surface. Second is students served. How many? Well, approximately 30% of the baccalaureate degrees year in and year out are produced by the University of Oregon. And probably all except a small proportion of those public university baccalaureates are produced by Oregon State University and Portland State University. So these three research universities together produce in excess of 80% of the baccalaureate degrees that, again, are one of those benchmarks that marks the difference between whether or not someone really has to struggle during the course of a lifetime and one is at least has an opportunity to succeed. How well do we serve our students, and how many do we serve? The chair asked a question about state infusions of funds and what difference that makes. And although my evidence is impressionistic, I think it's solid, Madam Chair. The reinvestment in higher education in 1999, one of the few biennia in which I've been president in which there has actually been an infusion of funds, was followed, I'm sad to report that, but it's true, it resulted in an immediate infusion of both applicants and graduates of the institution that can be tracked directly from that investment of funds. Similarly, as I think Dr. Leach reported to you, during the Measure 5 cutbacks, which immediately preceded my tenure as president, the cutback of higher education at that time resulted in the loss of students in the thousands, lost them altogether. They did not go to community colleges, and they did not go to the Oregon University system. They didn't go any place in post-secondary education that we can register at all. And this is probably more than 10,000 students at that time. The legislature in this last session, as you know, did another period of reinvestment, and we celebrated briefly for approximately 7 months before the current economic cycle worldwide has changed, really, all of our landscapes. And in that period of time, we have seen a huge spike in our enrollments and in our proposed applications. This last fall, we took care of teaching and counseling and greeting as freshmen 800 more students than we had expected. That's expected based upon the same algorithms of admission, how many pay a deposit, how many then pay a housing deposit, how many show up for orientation. Everyone came. There was no attrition of the kind that we had expected. So we had a record high application rate a year ago, and record admissions and record show-ups. The application rate this year at the University of Oregon is 20% above that of last year. And that's both for non-resident students and for resident students. Obviously, we will not and cannot afford to admit 800 more this coming year. But I think that's an index, at least, not only of economic times, but frankly, the brands of our institutions. Students want to go. They want to go here. And so at least there's some impressionistic evidence that it's not only that, it's the Oregon Assistance Grants, the appropriation for which was significantly increased, and we see a direct responsiveness, particularly of first-time college attenders at the University of Oregon. And because we programmed our financial aid in order to take maximum advantage of this outreach, which, by the way, Oregon State University did as well, and I believe Portland State, we believe we've been able to serve far more low-income students far more effectively because of this state program than before. So the very high impact of the state appropriations dollar, and not just directly to the universities, crucial as that is, but also to the Oregon Assistance Commission for Student Scholarship Aid. So far in the brief time I've had, I hope I've spoken generally about the economic impact and about the student impact. And, of course, you ought to be worried about or at least interested in our students' progress and whether or not they're getting the quality education that, frankly, is their necessity in this world and that we believe is their birthright as Oregonians. And I think the answer is yes. As you know, you have performance indicators and have had so for about a decade, maybe more. And in the appropriations process, we confront those performance indicators. The Oregon Progress Board keeps track of them. So this is something that provides us indices that are pretty well defined and give us longitudinal data. And I'm pleased to say that, at least in the case of my university, and my colleagues surely will speak to theirs, those indicators are going steadily up. The level of student satisfaction, that is to say those who believe that their education was excellent or good, is above 85%. That's a significant increase of many percentage points over what it was a decade ago, and I believe is tribute to the classroom dedication of our faculty and the even better student services that we bring. Our graduation rates have improved, and one of the critical indicators, as I'm sure members of this committee know, the retention rate between the freshman year and the sophomore year. Those rates have also improved, and it's my impression that system-wide they tend to improve when there is actually money, incentive money for the retention rates. But frankly, since we've never been funded at what is the system's method for distribution, it's a little bit hard to say how effectively we are there. But encapsulating that point, if you're looking for some index as to whether the state tax dollar has been, although lean, has been spent efficiently and effectively in our institutions, I think the answer is yes. And I think the answer is also found in objective data that's available to you that shows, notwithstanding this period of leanness, that there really has been dedication to serving the student, especially the undergraduate student at our respective universities. Let me just digress for a moment to the issue of interinstitutional cooperation, because to the extent that I was able to hear the colloquy among you and my colleague, President Vivelle, I believe that that arose briefly. There's always been a concerted effort to avoid duplication in our state system, and my personal and institutional memory actually goes back to Measure 5 days, when in very brutal budget cuts, both horizontal and vertical, approximately 100 programs were eliminated throughout the state system of higher education. That includes whole academic departments and, in some cases, even schools and colleges. About 12 were added back, and so that meant a net 88 programs were reduced. So journalism was taken away from 3 institutions and just left in 1. We've always had pharmacy only in 1 place, vet med only in 1 place, law only in 1 place. But there was a concerted system-wide attempt, which hasn't really been eroded in the years since that time, to eliminate the kind of duplication that one might find elsewhere or might find in periods where the cornucopia is really full. I don't think you can say that honestly about the state system of higher education. In the case of the University of Oregon's programs in Portland, all of them virtually are consolidated now in that White Stag complex, existed in Portland before we consolidated them. So if anything, there are efficiencies in having things in a single plant in a single place. None of them, with the exception of architecture, is even duplicated by any other state system institution. And in this case, different kinds of architecture programs, that is graduate or undergraduate, are offered by each of the institutions, and we have a collaborative agreement among our deans that hasn't existed before that I think makes it a significant value-added proposition to have that disciplinary concentration between the two schools there. But we have journalism in that institution, in that building. It doesn't exist elsewhere. Law in that building, it doesn't exist elsewhere other than in private law schools throughout the state. And I think that list can go on. There are 20 institutions of private higher education in the state of Oregon. 13 of them are in the Portland metropolitan area. And the needs of that area, which obviously is the state's largest metropolitan area for educational programs of all kind, probably could not be met by twice the number of programs that we have. So if anything, the area is underserved simply because we are under-resourced more generally. So I realize that coming in at the end of a dialogue and trying to respond to it may be very misleading, but to the extent that's a concern of your committee, I and my colleagues would be pleased to respond. And I want to make another point, which is that President Vivelle and President Ray and I present a locked arms reality to you. I admire these two gentlemen very much. I deeply appreciate what their institutions do. We have extensive collaborations among ourselves. The Onami program in nanoscience, maybe being one of the nation's premier, not simply a state premier. The efforts to promote programs for the sustainability of our resources are done on each of the individual campuses, but also statewide, make a formidable presentation arrayed against anyone else's programs of a similar kind and any other institutions of higher education in the country. So I think that level of collaboration is something that not only should set you at ease, but also give you a sense of pride in the collaboration and communication among ourselves. We have different missions. The University of Oregon is an AAU university, Association of American Universities. There are only 62 on the North American continent. Each has been invited to be a member of this organization, and among its membership are the elite names of American higher education in terms of advancement of new knowledge and research. Oregon State University is a leading, and I mean leading, land-grant institution in the United States. It has programs in the sea, in space, and on land. One of the few institutions of its kind that has that full panoply of outreach programs and investigation programs and research programs into those areas of the human condition. With very significant national recognition, President Ray is a leader in that association. Portland State University is a leading urban university, probably not only in the United States, probably in the world, focusing on, as its mission has been quite carefully crafted and stewarded, on the development of research that's particularly appropriate to metropolitan areas and their futures, whether it's in transportation, population planning, social welfare, that list goes on. So our missions are taken together both collaborative and complementary to each other, and compared to stories I've heard from other institutions in other states, I think without the kind of acrimony that one might almost typically expect elsewhere. Finally, what keeps us awake at night, and what can you do for us, or what can we do for you? Obviously, we want to know what we can do for the Legislative Assembly, and because a public mission is part of what we do. That's the difference between us and even some of the most distinguished private institutions. We have a public mission, and it infuses everything that we do. We hope that you continue to assist our students to the maximum degree. The fact that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission literally ran out of money was a pending tragedy for our students. We made up the shortfall not because we have a spare pocket of change, but because we needed to reprogram money in order to keep our students, and because we've had private giving where we've raised approximately $100 million for student assistance over the last several years. But that's a one-time capacity to stop the flow out. It doesn't deal with the next problems of reprogramming for the next biennium. I think you've heard President Vivelle's response with respect to Portland State. I think you've heard also that Oregon State University is again making up the shortfall for its students for the balance of this academic year. But we need your help. The demographics of our student population are changing. By this time, 8 years from now, there will be three times the number of students from Latino background graduating from high school as there are now. That's the march of demography. It's obvious, it's challenging, and it's real. And there's not very much that will change it. And that's wonderful for the opportunity, and at the same time speaks to probable issues of financial aid that will be significantly greater in 8 years from now, just a short period of time than it is now. A second issue, of course, is general fund support. We realize that you are not the appropriating committee, but we also realize that your caucuses confer about these issues. State support is only about 13% of the University of Oregon's budget, but it's a crucial 13% because these dollars go for basic things such as faculty salary support and the disciplinary support of the essential undergraduate disciplines that are important for getting a baccalaureate degree. We at the University of Oregon are the most tuition-dependent institution in the state system. A higher proportion of our overall university support comes from student assistance than comes from any other place. And in fact, our non-resident students provide us greater revenue than the state of Oregon. So anything that the Legislative Assembly does to disturb our understanding of the basic market that students are willing to pay for their educations. And by the way, we always allow for financial aid. So in any tuition increase over a specified amount, probably 30% would immediately be set aside for financial aid so we can make it family income neutral in its overall impact. But any attempt that micromanages our capacity to generate revenues from this source is severely crippling. And I think I stated it carefully, but I don't think I overstated it. And that leads really to the final point, which is we realize there will come some point in this Legislative Assembly's life when it says, these are the dollars that are available, that's it. We've always faced that situation. Our most sincere request to you is let's face that together with a full understanding of the consequences, but I hope it will not also be accompanied by details about how we ought to micromanage our particular institutional management of the financial circumstances that we have, because that really does then inhibit the flexibility that one needs in times of severe budget shortfall. I realize I've stated that generally, but I hope it's a proposition about a compact of trust and understanding where the ultimate appropriation is accompanied at least by a degree of freedom that allows us to cope most effectively and most efficiently with what resources we do have available. Just a quick sketch of a number that I think you know, but it's good to remind us. 80% of our budget is salaries. 80%. And that would be true virtually of any other of the institutions that you see. But all that we do is based on our people. The expertise that we've assembled in our faculty, of which we're extraordinarily proud, as is Portland State, as is Oregon State, has come from literally the world. And so to face any notion that we would lose faculty or lose the capacity to keep highly motivated people motivated with a sense that they're in it together with the state is obviously one of the most serious problems that we face. Faculty salary levels are the single biggest thing that keeps me awake at night and that will keep my successor awake at night. Because we are not nearly where we need to be. We've made up some of the ground that we lost in Measure 5, but we're still far behind our competitors. And while I think we all know that the quality of life, the environmental paycheck, is a very big one for Oregonians, it doesn't send your own kids to college and it doesn't buy groceries. And so we are always potentially at the mercy of institutions which have greater resources and who want desperately those people who constitute the 80%. Madam Chair, I hope I haven't trespassed on someone else's time limit. I do appreciate the chance to give what apparently has been a soliloquy, and I'd be happy to respond to questions if you wish.
Thank you. It was very helpful. A question that I have, could you talk a little bit about whether there's a balance between our investment in opportunity grants and student aid and the core functions of the university related to salary? Is there a point where we need to find a balance in those two?
I think that's probably true in the part. I mean, the student assistance comes to us in the form of tuition fees, which in turn then cycle back through our internal funding models. And as I mentioned to this committee just a moment ago, that probably would have a greater impact on salaries at the University of Oregon than it would elsewhere because we are tuition dependent. Significantly more so than Portland State, Oregon State, or the regional institutions just because of the accidents of disciplinary mix and overall funding patterns over now many years. So I think it's almost an institution-by-institution question. I don't know that you can have a template for the whole system that would answer it in the same way, although it's a useful measure to try to see how it trades off.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Comp?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Thank you, Dr. Frohmeyer. I didn't hear your reference about dual enrollment programs like we heard at Portland State with Lane Community Colleges. You have an incredible public school system there in Springfield and Eugene with high schools. Can you speak to that about dual enrollment?
Yes, and I'd be happy to have the committee supplied with exact numbers, which I don't have at my fingertips mm-hmm. at this rostrum today. We have an extensive program of collaboration with Lane Community College right. And have for many years. Our single largest group of students, well, the largest group comes in the Tri-County area, but the single county mm-hmm. that gives the most students is Lane County with the Springfield School System and District 4J. I think that answer is correct. And community college transfers constitute a significant number of our students. And again, I want to be accurate, so I'll provide those to the committee because I think that is a helpful thing to look to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for being here. I think University of Oregon is one of the most beautiful campuses, or campi, what do you say, here in the state. And my daughter actually graduated from there, summa cum laude, and she is chosen since then to go out of state to go and attend a law school, which brings me to my two-part question. One, are there any statistics as to how many graduates of Oregon universities actually stay in the state versus those who transfer in from out of state, and do they find jobs within their respective fields?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and thank you, Representative Thatcher, Madam Chair. The figure that sticks in my mind is two-thirds. I want to leave enough room to correct that record, but a very significant majority of our students do stay in Oregon, or if they go elsewhere, they come back to Oregon. It makes a difference in terms of the brain drain where you go to undergraduate institution. And we have been a net importer of people with with baccalaureate and graduate degrees for a number of years, but that also accompanied the high-tech explosion when, as you know, there was $13 billion of investment in high technology in the space of just a few years. It really offset the spotted owl issue, although that still affects rural areas very seriously. But it masked what otherwise could have been catastrophic effects of the loss of some major manufacturing jobs when high technology came in. So we know that that's significant. We know that the net import, the increase in educational attainment levels of Oregonians in that period right after Measure 5 was due almost exclusively to in-migrants rather than to increases in our production of people with college degrees, which actually fell.
I guess I didn't hear if people are actually finding jobs within the respective fields that
yes.
they
yeah.
study. They are.
Okay,
good. Yeah. That's good to hear. Thanks.
And to some degree, that's also found in student satisfaction measurement, because we also measure student satisfaction after they have left institutions, even up to 5 years. And again, the expert on that is Susan Weeks, who could provide you with that. But I think you'd actually find quite reassuring. We're pleased that your daughter enjoyed her stay at the university.
Well, I hope she comes back.
I really do.
Representative Parker.
Looks like my son may be on your campus starting in the fall. But thanks so much for another highly informative presentation here. Out of many facts that I tried to jot down here, a couple of them are jumping out at me, and I wanted to make sure that I've got them right, and
yes.
if so, follow up with a question, if I may, Madam.
Yes, you may.
I think you said U of O is the only AAU institution in Oregon and that it is the most tuition-dependent of the Oregon State Universities, correct?
I said both, yes.
Okay.
Actually, the University of Oregon is one of only two AAU institutions in the entire northwest quarter of the United States. You have to go as far east as Minnesota, far south as Iowa, Boulder, Colorado, and Lincoln, Nebraska to find the next ones. But the rest of the country, even though vast and beautiful, has only the University of Washington, University of Oregon as AAU members. That's correct.
Okay. How do we do... out of the limited coffers that we have here, how do we do in terms of the other AAU institutions in terms of state support?
We are, to my memory, Representative Parker, the lowest state support per student of any AAU university. A staggering comparison is the University of Washington, which I believe is something like three times the per student support from the state as the University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I can get you those numbers precisely. They will not please you, but they will be accurate.
They're already not pleasing me.
But,
especially since you're able to generate the return, if you will, of $1.2 billion on the $80 million that we do give you?
That's correct. Thank you.
Person of Enormous, did you have a question?
Well, I wanted to, yes, Madam Chair, I wanted to follow up on what you said, because it's not only Washington, but it's also Washington State that also gets better cost per child or cost per student than we do.
There's no question about that. It's just that I'm more familiar with the University of Washington numbers because they are an AAU comparator. Washington State would be a land grant comparator, I believe.
Okay.
Great. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciated your comment. Well, first of all, let me say, Mr. President, it's really truly an honor to have you here, to be on this side of the table facing you, considering all that you've done for Oregon. You mentioned the changing demographics and the need to plan for those demographics and to adjust to them. And I'm wondering what the university is doing along those lines. You know, what your strategy is. You've talked about, of course, about the Opportunity Grant as a way to make the university more affordable. You know, transfer from the community colleges is, of course, another avenue. What are you doing along those lines and in ways of making the university a more welcoming environment? Not that it's not welcoming now, but just more an environment where non-traditional students can succeed.
No, thank you, Representative Dimbrough and Madam Chair. That's a very good question and one which has many, many complex moving parts. We developed, and not without internal debate, of some not ferocity, at least it's enduring nature. We developed a diversity plan which applies to every single unit on the campus, in which each one was responsible for developing its own template to be more conscious of the racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and other issues respecting Oregon's ability to be part of the 21st century in a meaningful way. And that is now well underway in ways that I think will have multiple aspects. It's changed our student recruiting and where we recruit and how we recruit. It's changed our scholarship administration and how we do that. It is, to some degree, made our faculty and staff hiring processes even more sort of self-consciously aware of the multiple potential applicants that could be available for positions. So I would say that in that respect, it's affected almost every aspect of the university's ongoing operations, with a retrospective view on its successes that's due next year. So we'll be able to have at least a comprehensive self-portrait and reflective portrait that I hope will tell us whether we're on the right track or not. The applicant pools that we're getting this year are quite encouraging with respect to diversity, because they show that students, at least in proportion to their numbers in the overall population, maybe even more so, are applying to the university. So it doesn't have that intimidating, standoffish, elitist feel that one might fear under those circumstances. But much work to be done. And as I say, the demographic is changing so rapidly that I think it will still, notwithstanding these warnings, catch people by surprise. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you very much. We're pleased to respond to your questions, and if I've misspoken on anything, we'd be happy to clarify it in writing to you.
Well, thank you for coming today. President Ray. So we've put you at the end of the day, which means you have less time, but you did get to display your colors on national television as part of the presidential inauguration yesterday, so it's only fair.
We didn't know if anyone would notice. It's so subtle. Thank you, Madam Chairman, for the opportunity to speak to you. If you don't mind, I'll make some observations and apologize in advance if I repeat observations that my colleagues have already made, and I'll try to keep it short.
And before you do that, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Ed Ray, President, Oregon State University. If I can, let me say a little bit about the university and what the status of things are and how they're moving forward, and then say something about the governor's proposed budget and how we see that playing out. And then I think, as Dave did, I'll have a bit of a plea at the end for what I would hope you would do, try to do going forward, and what responsibilities and accountability we accept in the bargain. First, let me say on the state of the university that we have, some of you may know, we're in our first university-wide fundraising campaign. We went public in October of 2007. We set a goal for June of 2011 of $625 million. We're now at $477 million with 2.5 years to go. As bad as the economy has been, in the first half of this fiscal year, we've raised $46 million, including $16 million in December. That's more than we raised in 2002, 2003, the year before I came here, in the first half of this year. So if you can do that in the worst financial crisis since the Depression, it suggests you're doing a number of things right. So we feel very good about the campaign and where it's going. And I'll say a little more in a bit about what we're doing with that campaign funding effort, because it feeds into some of the other areas that I know you're very interested in. Let me also say something about research funding. Last year, at the end of the fiscal year, our total research grants and contracts totaled $231 million for the year. That represented a $75 million increase over the last 5 years and a $25 million increase last year. And in case you're worried that the momentum might be waning, In October of 2008, while the financial markets were tanking, we brought in research grants and contracts of $34 million. It's the largest month in the history of the university. We have a strategic plan that we established in 2003, shortly after I got here, to give us focus and direction going forward, with a long-term objective of being among the top 10 land-grant universities in America. We set a number of targets and goals for ourselves for 2008. We've achieved some. We haven't done as well in others, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions about that. But now it's time to update the strategic plan and talk about what our objectives are for 2013. And I'll say just briefly that we do an annual report card where we look at all of the metrics that we've developed and report to certainly the OUS board, but to the university community on how we've managed in the last year and where we stand relative to the targets that we've set for ourselves. And going forward, I think all of us can appreciate that you don't get to the top by mimicking other people. And the basic premise that we've worked with from day one is we need to not so much worry about what the top 10 by reputation land-grant universities might be doing today, but to think about what is it important to be an important contributor to 10, 20, 30 years from now. We've thought hard about that in terms of the programs we already have, in terms of the programs where we think we can achieve excellence. And we've settled basically on three areas that we think can be sort of signature programs for the university that are really quite different from the other universities in the OUS system. The first one is really focusing on, for want of a better term, the science of earth, of sustainable earth ecosystems. It involves all of our ocean and atmospheric research, our environmental studies. We had the leading, were judged to have the leading conservation biology program in the country last year. We arguably have the leading agricultural sciences program, forestry programs in the country. All of that talent and capability in the natural resource environment, the living environment, we think positions us to be a major contributor to not only understanding the world around us, but contributing to finding solutions for issues involving alternative fuels and climate change and how to be better stewards of our environment going forward. Second area focuses on public health and wellness. We have a wonderful medical school in Oregon. We don't need a second one. Our focus really is on preventive measures, healthy lifestyle choices that can benefit people going forward, prevent health problems from developing through nutrition, as I say, lifestyle choices, diet. We have the Linus Pauling Institute at Oregon State University. We're about to break ground on the Linus Pauling Science Center, which combines elements of chemistry in the Linus Pauling Institute. It includes research, teaching laboratories in chemistry, as well as classrooms. So we're bringing students and research together around these issues of better health, better health care before people develop health problems. We've got our College of Pharmacy, which works on translational research, drug discovery, and development. Our College of Health and Human Sciences, which works with nutrition, physical issues, disabilities, and adaptations. Our College of Veterinary Medicine does translational research from other organisms to human health needs. Our College of Science, Biological Sciences, our plant and other species science in our College of Agricultural Sciences, all of those can contribute to that area, and we think help us distinguish our contributions to the to Oregon and the nation and the world. And then finally, we talk about healthy economy, economic growth, and economic development and social progress. We already think we're making a significant contribution to the economic vitality of Oregon and the nation. I heard the last of what Dave was saying about the multiplier effect of their programs. Our programs, supported by the state, include not just the sort of traditional university programs that you would think of, but also the statewide programs, the Extension Service, the research experiment stations, the Forest Research Lab. And when you add that all together, that represents about 20% of our total funding. If you looked at the sort of apples-to-apples comparison that President Frohnmayer was talking about, we're down about 14% of our overall academic activity within the traditional university setting coming from the state, but we also have direct funding for the statewide programs. So the two added together are about 20% of our total funding. If you take 2007 as an example, our overall resources were about $675 million, so about $135 million from the state. We tried to make a very conservative estimate of our economic impact on the state. And when we talk about economic impact, and I apologize if you've already talked about this, but we're talking about as if you were producing cars or donuts or television sets or whatever. We're really saying, what's the contemporary economic impact? How much current economic activity is generated by the 20% or $135 million that we get from the state? In 2007, that was $1.5 billion for the year. And it really, I think, it doesn't do justice, and I'm sure other colleagues mentioned this, to the impact of higher education, because so much of what we do is research and discovery and preparation of people to be leaders of tomorrow, to create the technology and innovations that bring new products to market that reap benefits for society in the longer run, not just at the current moment. And so if one could somehow get the discounted present value of what we're doing right now, I would argue that it's a substantial multiplier of the $1.5 billion that we can identify in any given year. Let me turn quickly to the governor's budget. As you know, the governor proposed a budget that increased support for education by about 5% going into the next biennium. Obviously, we all understand that the economic picture has deteriorated since the time the governor made his recommendations based on the forecasts that were available in November. We're already hearing discussions about yet further budget reductions for state enterprises for the remainder of this biennium, and obviously real challenges going into the next biennium. We would consider it quite wonderful if we could get the governor's original budget proposal. But I think all of us, and this part I really mean seriously, you have no happy choices to make. I get it. Any responsible person gets it. You people deserve a lot of credit for stepping up, for being willing to speak on issues, to face voters, to have the media decide every day of the week whether they think you're doing a good or lousy job, and you keep plugging ahead, and you're going to have to make choices, I know, during this session that are going to be awful to have to make, choices among alternatives that none of us would want to turn away from, whether it's in terms of programs for preschool children or families who need assistance, to those who need health care desperately. You have hard choices to make. We get it. I'm not asking you to look away from those other needs. But what I'd like to have you have a sense of, and I hope you've already started to get a sense of it from the things I've said about our research activities, about our fundraising capabilities, And about this overall statement about the economic impact of the university, and it's true for all of the universities, is that we not only try to be good stewards of the resources that you're able to give us, we really try to leverage them and magnify the impact for the people of Oregon of the investments that you make in the universities. And one of the things that I've learned over many years dealing with budget difficulties, not just here in Oregon, but in Ohio, where I spent many years before I came here, is that even in the worst of times, what gives people hope is that you're investing in something for the future, something positive that you know is going to make a difference. And I don't envy you the task, but I implore you to remember that investment in education is an investment in futures that can be realized. And the challenge, I don't envy you, is making that decision about where the balance is between current needs and investment for the future. And it's something that I know you're going to have to wrestle with, and I know we'll give your best effort to. Let me talk a little bit, though, about the things that are possible as a result of the governor's budget. One that I'm very pleased we've been able to implement is what we call our Bridge to Success program. And I put this in the category of student access and what we're doing about that. We started the program, came up with the idea last spring to take students who qualified for Oregon Opportunity Grant money, the shared responsibility model money, could qualify for Pell Grants, remissions from us, scholarship aid because of the work we've been able to do with our foundation, and to try to maximize the number of students that we could give admissions to and access to an Oregon State University education without having to pay tuition and fees. And our goal was 1,500 for this fall, and that would represent about 10% of the Oregon students who go to Oregon State University. We're at 3,400. We have provided 3,400 Oregon students with access to an education in Oregon State without tuition, without fees, and close to half of them have also gotten additional money for books and for incidental expenses. We've done it by combining the monies they could get from the Oregon Opportunity Grant, Pell Grants, remissions, and scholarships. How do you get that kind of scholarship support? As part of our campaign, as great as totals are to talk about, we set a goal for scholarships and fellowships for students of $100 million by the time the campaign ends in June 2011. We've already raised $73 million. That's why we've been able to create this program, and as I know President Frohnmayer and apparently President Vivelle indicated, we also have found the resources to keep student funding whole despite the unfortunate drawback on Oregon Opportunity Grant funds. So all of our students who are benefiting from that will be made whole by $500,000 additional dollars that we've gotten in scholarship support, contemporary support, through our work with the OSU Foundation. I heard a question about dual enrollment programs. I'm very proud of the fact that Oregon State University has a dual enrollment agreement with every community college in Oregon, all 17. Our original partner was Lynn Benton Community College. That's where we've had the longest relationship going back to 1998. We've had more than 3,500 students graduate from Oregon State University who began their college studies in a community college. So we're very, very proud of that program. On the capital front, you know about the proposals that the governor has made for funding for deferred maintenance. We've got a backlog of about $200 million. But we're also taking steps to leverage whatever we get for funding of capital projects. And one of the things that I'm very concerned about is the G-bond match for privately raised funds. I mentioned the Linus Pauling Science Center before. It's a $65 million project that we'll be breaking ground on very soon. We raised half of that money, approximately $32.5 million, from private funds because we were able to tell people, if you support us, we can't guarantee the state will be able to do the match, but the state has made an effort and has been able to match in the past. If you give us money, we may be able to leverage that into something even more extraordinary. And so the ability to rely upon G-bond matches for appropriate projects has been extraordinarily valuable to us. As I said, we're breaking ground on the Linus Pauling Science Center. We've got a Haley Ford Center for families and children that we'll be going forward with. We have a Student Success Center that we hope to get G-bond match for, where we've raised $7 million in private funds, and we're hoping we can get the matching state funds so that we can build a $14 million facility for all students. And the intention is to use that to include programs that we hope will improve first-year retention rates, time to graduation, and six-year graduation rates for all students at Oregon State University.
And President Ray, I apologize, but I have to ask you to wrap up, as the next committee is going to start in this room in about 4 minutes.
Okay. We're doing a lot of collaboration across the state. Hopefully you've heard colleagues talk about ONAMI, OTRADI, INVEST, Oregon Inc. I think the state deserves kudos, even if we don't have a lot of resources. The notion of the state finding strategic initiatives to bring education, business partners, and government resources to bear on areas of focus for the future, if you think about it, is analogous to what we're trying to do at Oregon State University. I've identified three areas where we think we can have a significant impact in the years going forward. The state is trying to do the same thing through Oregon Inc., and we're an active partner in that and very excited about that. So let me get to my pitch then, if I ain't got a minute and a half left. And that is, don't micromanage us. I heard President Frohnmayer say it. We're going to have to make additional cuts for this biennium sometime in the last four of the 24 months that we're funded. We get paid to manage resources. Give us guideposts. I think we can all agree on sort of broad guidelines. We want to protect student access to courses. We want to do what we can to make sure they don't lose the ability to graduate in a timely fashion. There are general principles we can agree with, but we don't need to have you tell us that we can't do salary increases, we got to furlough staff, and all the other myriad of things that people are talking about. Keep it simple. Give us a budget. Tell us what to manage to. We'll manage to it. Hold us accountable for what we get done. We're happy to report back to you. In the bargain, what I would say to you is I know that there's some contention about what to do about the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund. I think the prudent thing to do, and I'm an economist, is to try to hold those in reserve until we know what we've got to deal with next biennium. I'm not asking you to give us that money. I'm asking you to give us a number and tell us to manage to it, and I guarantee you we will.
Well, thank you very much for coming today, and I'm sorry that you don't get to experience our questions. I'm sure we'll get the chance to do that with you later in the session. Thank you all for coming to this hearing today. Friday, we have our hearing on the 529 plan. We expect an overflow crowd, so we will be meeting in Hearing Room B. And one more plea, if you have questions,
B.
Hearing Room B.
Thank
B as in boy. Watch your email. Roxy will be sending you the Morningstar report. And if you have questions you anticipate asking, if you could get those to me, I'd appreciate it a lot. And we are adjourned.